went better than I expected, Mr. Savaloy remarked as the warlord strode out. Was that an attempt at a little bit of psychological warfare there, Mr. Rincewind?
Is that what it was? I know about that kind of stuff, said Cohen. It's where you bang your shield all night before the fight so the enemy can't get any sleep, and you sing, "We're gonna cut your tonkers off," and stuff like that.
Similar, said Mr. Savaloy diplomatically. But it failed to work, I'm afraid. Lord Hong and his generals are rather too sophisticated. It's a great shame you couldn't try it on the common soldiers. There was a faint squeak of rabbit behind them. They turned and looked at the somewhat underage cadre of the Red Army that was being ushered in. Butterfly was with them. She even gave Rincewind a very faint smile. Rincewind had always relied on running away, but sometimes perhaps you had to stand and fight, if only because there was nowhere left to run. But he was no good at all with weapons, at least the normal sort. He said, "If we leave the palace now, we'll be killed, right?"
"I doubt it," said Mr. Savaloy. "It's become a matter of the art of war now. Someone like Hong would probably slit our throats, but now war is declared. Things have to be done according to custom."
Rincewind took a deep breath. "It's a million to one chance," he said. "But it might just work." The four horsemen whose ride presages the end of the world are known to be death, war, famine, and pestilence. But even less significant events have their own horsemen. For example, the four horsemen of the common cold are Sniffles, Chesty, Nostril, and Lack of Tissues. The four horsemen whose appearance foreshadows any public holiday are Storm, Gales, Sleet, and Contraflow. Among the armies encamped in the broad alluvial plain around Hung Hung, the invisible horsemen known as Misinformation, Rumour, and Gossip saddled up. A large army encamped has all the tedious problems of a city without any of the advantages. Its watchfires and picket lines are, after a while, open to local civilians, especially if they have anything to sell, and even more so if they are women whose virtue has a certain commercial element, and even sometimes if they appear to be selling food which is a break from the monotonous army diet. The food currently on sale was certainly such a break.
"Pork balls! Pork balls! Get them while they—"
There was a pause as the vendor mentally tried out ways of ending the sentence and gave up.
"Pork balls! On a stick! How about you, Shogun? You look like... here, aren't you the—"
Shut up.
Rincewind pulled DMH Dibala into the shadows by a tent.
The trader looked at the
anguished face framed between a eunuch outfit and a big straw hat.
"It's the wizard, isn't it? How are you?"
"You know how you seriously wanted to become very rich in international trade," Rincewind said.
"Yes, can we start?"
Soon. But there's something you must do. You know this rumour about the army of invisible vampire ghosts that's heading this way?" DMH Dibala's eyes swivelled nervously, but it was part of his stock in trade never to appear to be ignorant of anything except, perhaps, how to give correct change.
"Yes,"
he said.
"The one about there being millions of them," said Rincewind, "and very hungry on account of not having eaten on the way, and made specially fierce by the great wizard."
Yes.
"Well, it's not true."
"It's not?"
"You don't believe me? After all, I ought to know."
"Good point.
And we don't want people to panic, do we?"
"Very bad for business, panic,"
said DMH, nodding uncomfortably.
"So make sure you tell people there's no truth in this rumour, will you? Set their minds at rest."
"Good idea. These invisible vampire ghosts, do they carry money of any sort?"
"No, because they don't exist."
"Ah, yes, I forgot."
"And there are not 2,300,009 of them," said Rincewind.
He was rather proud of this little detail.
"Not 2,300,009 of them,"
said DMH, a little glassy-eyed.
"Absolutely not. There are not 2,300,009 of them, no matter what anyone says, nor has the great wizard made them twice as big as normal."
"Good man. Now, I'd better be off."
Rincewind hurried away. The trader stood in thought for a while. It stole over him that he'd probably sold enough things for now, and he might as well go home and spend a quiet night in a barrel in the root cellar with a sack over his head.
His route led him through quite a large part of the camp. He made sure that soldiers he met knew there was no truth in the rumour, even though this invariably meant that, first of all, he had to tell them what the rumour actually was. A toy rabbit squeaked nervously.
"And I'm afraid of the big invisible vampire ghosts,"
sobbed Favourite Pearl. The soldiers around this particular campfire tried to comfort her, but unfortunately there was no one to comfort them.
"And I heard they already ate some men."
One or two soldiers looked over their shoulders. There was nothing to be seen in the darkness. This wasn't, however, a reassuring sign. The Red Army moved obliquely from campfire to campfire. Rincewind had been very specific. He'd spent all his adult life, at least those parts of it where he wasn't being chased by things with more legs than teeth, in Unseen University, and he felt he knew what he was talking about here. "Don't tell people anything," he said. "Don't tell them. You didn't get to survive as a wizard in UU by believing what people told you. You believed what you were not told. Don't tell them. Ask them. Ask them if it's true. You can beg them to tell you it's not true, or you can even tell them you've been told to tell them it's not true, and that is the best of all." Because Rincewind knew very well that when the four rather small and nasty horsemen of panic ride out, there is a good job done by misinformation, rumour and gossip, but they are as nothing compared to the fourth horseman, whose name is Denial. After an hour, Rincewind felt quite unnecessary. There were conversations breaking out everywhere, particularly in those areas on the edge of the camps, where the night stretched away so big and dark and so very obviously empty. "All right, so how come they're saying there's not 2,300,009 of them, eh? If there's none of them, then why is there a number?"
"Look, there's no such thing as invisible vampire ghosts, all right?"
"Oh, yeah? How do you know? Have you ever seen any?"
"Listen, I went and asked the captain and he says he's certain there's no invisible ghosts out there."
"How can he be certain if he can't see them?"
"He says there's no such thing as invisible vampire ghosts at all."
"Oh? How come he's saying that all of a sudden? My grandfather told me there's millions of them outside the..."
"Hold on. Hold on. What's out there?"
"What?"
"Could have sworn I heard something." "I can't see anything." "Oh, no."
Things must have filtered through to the High Command, because getting on towards midnight, trumpets were sounded around the camps and a special proclamation was read out. It confirmed the reality of vampire ghosts in general, but denied their existence in any specific here-and-now sense. It was a masterpiece of its type, particularly since it brought the whole subject to the ears of soldiers the Red Army hadn't been able to reach yet. An hour later, the situation had reached the point of criticality, and Rincewind was hearing things he personally hadn't made up, and, on the whole, would much rather not hear. He'd chat with a couple of soldiers and say, "I'm sure there's no huge, hungry army of vampire ghosts," and get told, "No, there's seven old men."
"Just seven old men?"
"I've heard they're very old," said a soldier. "Like too old to die. I heard from someone at the palace that they can walk through walls and make themselves invisible."
"Oh, come on," said Rincewind. "Seven old men fighting this whole army."
"Makes you think, eh?
Corporal Toshi says the great wizard is helping them. Stands to reason. I wouldn't be fighting a whole army if I didn't have a lot of magic on my side."
Anyone know what this great wizard looks like?" said Rincewind.
"They say he's taller than a house and got three heads."
Rincewind nodded encouragingly.
"I heard," said a soldier, "that the Red Army is going to fight on their side too."
"So what? Corporal Toshi says they're just a bunch of kids."
"No, I heard the real Red Army, you know.
The Red Army ain't going to side with the barbarian invaders. Anyway, there's no such thing as the Red Army. They're just a myth."
"Like the invisible vampire ghosts," said Rincewind, giving the clockwork of anxiety another little turn.
Yeah.
He left them arguing. No one was deserting. Running off into a night full of non-specific terrors was worse than staying in camp. But that was all to the good, he decided. It meant that the really frightened people were staying put and seeking reassurance from their comrades. And there was nothing like someone repeating, "I'm sure there's no vampire wizards," and going to the latrine four times an hour to put backbone into a platoon. Rincewind crept back towards the city, round a tent in the shadows, and collided with a horse, which trod heavily on his foot.
"Your wife is a big hippo."
"Sorry."
Rincewind froze. both hands clutching his aching foot. He knew only one person with a voice like a cemetery in midwinter. He tried to hop backwards and collided with another horse.
"Rincewind, isn't it?"
said Death.
"Yes. Good evening. I don't believe you have met War. Rincewind, War. War, Rincewind."
War touched his helmet in salute.
"Pleasure's all mine," he said.
He indicated the other three riders.
"Like to introduce you to my sons, Terror and Panic, and my daughter, Clancy."
The children chorused a hello. Clancy was scowling, looking about 7 years old, and was wearing a hard hat and a pony club badge.
"I wasn't expecting to see you here, Rincewind."
"Oh, good." Death pulled an hourglass out of his robe, held it up to the moonlight, and sighed. Rincewind craned to see how much sand was left.
"However, I could..."
"Don't you make any special arrangement just on my account," said Rincewind hurriedly. I expect you're all here for the battle?"
"Yes. It promises to be extremely short."
"Who's going to win?"
"Now, you know I wouldn't tell you that, even if I knew."
"Even if you knew," said Rincewind, "I thought you were supposed to know everything." Death held up a finger. Something fluttered down through the night. Rincewind thought it was a moth, although it looked less fluffy and had a strange speckled pattern on its wings. It settled on the extended digit for a moment, and then flew up and away again.
"On a night like this," said Death, "the only certain thing is uncertainty. Trite, I know, but true."
Somewhere on the horizon, thunder rumbled.
"I'll just be sort of going, then," said Rincewind.
"Don't be a stranger," said Death, as the wizard hurried off.
"Odd person," said War.
"With him here, even uncertainty is uncertain. And I'm not sure even about that."
War pulled a large paper-wrapped package out of his saddlebag.
"We've got, let's see now, egg and cress, chicken tikka, and mature cheese with crunchy pickle, I think."
"They do such marvellous things with sandwiches these days."
"Oh, and bacon surprise."
"Really? What is so surprising about bacon?"
"I don't know. I suppose it comes as something of a shock to the pig."
Ridcully had been having a long wrestle with himself and had won.
We're going to bring him back," he said. "It's been 4 days, and then we can send them back their bloody tube thing. It gives me the willies."
The senior wizards looked at one another. No one was very keen on a university with a Rincewind component, but the metal dog did give them the willies. No one had wanted to go near it. They'd piled some tables around it and tried to pretend it wasn't there.
"All right," said the Dean, "but Stibbons kept going on about things weighing the same, right? If we send that back, won't it mean Rincewind arrives here going very fast?"
"Mr. Stibbons says he's working on the spell," said Ridcully. "Or we could pile some mattresses up at one end of the hall or something."
The bursar raised a hand.
"Yes, bursar," said Ridcully encouragingly.
"Ho, landlord, a pint of your finest ale," said the bursar.
Good, said Ridcully. That's settled then. I've already told Mr. Stibbons to start looking.
On that demonic device?
Yes.
Then nothing can possibly go wrong, said the Dean sourly.
A trumpet of lobsters, if you'd be so good.
And the bursar agreed.
The warlords had gathered in Lord Hong's chambers. They carefully kept a distance from one another, as befitted enemies who were in the most shaky of alliances. Once the barbarians were dealt with, the battle might still continue, but they wanted assurance on one particular point.
"No," said Lord Hong, "let me make this absolutely clear. There is no invisible army of blood-sucking ghosts, do you understand? The people beyond the wall are just like us, except vastly inferior in every respect, of course, but totally visible."
One or two of the lords did not look convinced.
"And all this talk about the Red Army?" said one of them.
"The Red army, Lord Tang, is an undisciplined rabble that shall be put down with resolute force.
You know what the Red Army and the peasants are talking about, said Lord Tang. They say that thousands of years ago it...
They say that thousands of years ago a wizard who did not exist took mud and lightning and made soldiers that couldn't die,
said Lord Hong.
Yes, it's a story, Lord Tang. A story made up by peasants who did not understand what really happened. One Sun Mirror's army just had...
Lord Hong waved a hand vaguely.
Better armour, better discipline. I'm not frightened of ghosts, and I'm certainly not afraid of a legend that probably never existed.
Yes, but...
Soothsayer,
snapped Lord Hong. The soothsayer, who hadn't been expecting it, gave a start.
Yes, my lord.
How are those entrails coming along?
They're about ready, my lord,
said the soothsayer. The soothsayer was rather worried. This must have been the wrong kind of bird, he told himself. About the only thing the entrails were telling him was that if he got out of this alive, he, the soothsayer, might be lucky enough to enjoy a nice chicken dinner. But Lord Hong sounded like a man with the most dangerous kind of impatience.
And what do they tell you?
The future is, the future is...
Chicken entrails had never looked like this. For a moment he thought they were moving.
It is uncertain,
he hazarded.
Be certain,
said Lord Hong.
Who will win in the morning?
Shadows flickered across the table. Something was fluttering around the light. It looked like an undistinguished yellow moth with black patterns on its wings. The soothsayer's precognitive abilities, which were considerably more powerful than he believed, told him, "This is not a good time to be a clairvoyant." On the other hand, there was never a good time to be horribly executed, so,
without a shadow of a doubt, he said, "the enemy will be most emphatically beaten."
"How can you be so certain?"
said Lord McSweeney. The soothsayer bridled.
You see this wobbly bit near the kidneys? You want to argue with this green trickly thing? You know all about liver suddenly, all right?
So, there you are, said Lord Hong. Fate smiles upon us.
Even so, Lord Tang began, the men are very...
You can tell the men...
Lord Hong began. He stopped. He smiled.
You can tell the men, he said, that there is a huge army of invisible vampire ghosts.
What?
Yes.
Lord Hong began to stride up and down, snapping his fingers.
Yes, there is a terrible army of foreign ghosts, and this has so enraged our own ghosts. Yes, 1,000 generations of our ancestors are riding on the wind to repel this barbaric invasion. The ghosts of the Empire are arising, millions and millions of them. Even our demons are furious at this intrusion. They will descend like a mist of claws and teeth to... Yes, Lord Sung?
The warlords were looking at one another nervously.
Are you sure, Lord Hong?
Lord Hong's eyes gleamed behind his tiny spectacles.
Make the necessary proclamations, he said.
But only a few hours ago we told the men there were no...
Tell them differently.
But will they believe that there...
They will believe what they are told,
shouted Lord Hong.
If the enemy thinks his strength lies in deceit, then we will use their deceit against them. Tell the men that behind them will be 1 billion ghosts of the Empire.
The other warlords tried to avoid his gaze. No one was actually going to suggest that your average soldier would not be totally happy with ghosts front and rear, especially given the capriciousness of ghosts.
Good,
said Lord Hong. He looked down.
Are you still here?
Clearing up my giblets, my lord, squealed the soothsayer.
He picked up the remains of his stricken chicken and ran for it. After all, he told himself as he pelted back home, it's not as though I said, whose enemy? Lord Hong was left alone. He realised he was shaking. It was probably fury, but perhaps things could be turned to his advantage even so. Barbarians came from outside, and to most people everywhere, outside was the same. Yes, the barbarians were a minute detail, easily disposed of, but carefully managed perhaps might figure in his overall strategy. He was breathing heavily, too. He walked into his private study and shut the door. He pulled out the key. He opened the box. There was a few minutes' silence, except for the rustle of cloth. Then Lord Hong looked at himself in the mirror. He'd gone to great lengths to achieve this. He had used several agents, none of whom knew the whole plan. But the Ankh-Morpork tailor had been good at his work, and the measurements had been followed exactly. From pointy boots to hose to doublet, cloak and hat with a feather in it, Lord Hong knew he was a perfect Ankh-Morpork gentleman. The cloak was lined with silk. The clothes felt uncomfortable and touched him in unfamiliar ways, but those were minor details. This was how a man looked in a society that breathed, that moved, that could go somewhere. He'd walk through the city on that first great day, and the people would be silent when they saw their natural leader. It never crossed his mind that anyone would say, "Yeah, what a tough. Avar for brick at him." The ants scurried. The thing that went parp went parp. The wizards stood back. There wasn't much else to do when Hex was working at full speed, except watch the fish and oil the wheels from time to time. There were occasional flashes of octarine from the tubes. Hex was spelling several hundred times a minute. It was as simple as that. It would take a human more than an hour to do an ordinary finding spell, but Hex could do them faster, over and over again. It was netting the whole occult sea in the search of one slippery fish. It achieved, after 93 minutes, what would otherwise have taken the faculty several months.
"You see?"
said Ponder, his voice shaking a little as he took the line of blocks out of the hopper.
"I said he could do it."
"Who's he?" said Ridcully.
"Hex."
"Oh, you mean it?"
"That's what I said, sir. Yes."
Another thing about the Horde, Mr. Savaloy had noticed, was their ability to relax. The old men had the cat-like ability to do nothing when there was nothing to do. They'd sharpened their swords, they'd had a meal, big lumps of meat for most of them, and some kind of gruel for Mad Hamish, who dribbled most of it down his beard, and assured its wholesomeness by dragging the cook in, nailing him to the floor by his apron, and suspending a large axe on a rope that crossed a beam in the roof and was held at the other end by Cohen while he ate. Then they sharpened their swords again, out of habit, and stopped. Occasionally one of them would whistle a snatch of a tune through what remained of his teeth, or search a bodily crevice for a particularly fretful louse. Mainly, though, they just sat and stared at nothing. After a long while, Caleb said,
"You know, I've never been to XXXX. Been everywhere else. Often wondered what it's like."
"Got shipwrecked there once," said Vincent. "Weird place. Lousy with magic. There's beavers with beaks and giant rats with long tails that hops around the place and boxes with one another. Blackfellas wandering round all over the place. They say they're in a dream. Bright, though. Show 'em a bit of desert with one dead tree in it. Next minute they've found a three-course meal with fruits and nuts to follow. Beer's good, too."
"Sounds like it."
There was another long pause. Then,
"I suppose they've got minstrels here. Be a bit of a bloody waste, wouldn't it, if we all got killed and no one made up any songs about it?
Bound to have loads of minstrels, a city like this."
"No problem there, then?"
"No.
No."
There was another lengthy pause.
"Not that we're going to get killed."
"Right. I don't intend to start getting killed at my time of life."
Another pause.
"Cohen?"
"Yep."
"You a religious man at all?"
"Well, I've robbed lots of temples and killed a few mad priests in my time. Don't know if that counts."
What do your tribe believe happens to you when you die in battle?
Oh, these big fat women in horned helmets take you off to the halls of Io, where there is fighting and carousing and quaffing forever.
Another pause. You mean, like, really forever?
Suppose so.
Because generally you get fed up even with turkey by about day four.
All right. What do you lot believe?
I think we go off to hell in a boat made of toenail clippings. Something like that, anyway.
Another long pause.
But it's not worth talking about, because we're not going to get killed today.
You said it.
It's not worth dying if all you've got to look forward to is leftover meat and floating around in a boat smelling of your socks, is it, eh?
Another pause. Down in Clatch, they believe if you lead a good life, you're rewarded by being sent to a paradise with lots of young women.
That's your reward, is it?
Dunno. Maybe it's their punishment. But I do remember you eat sherbet all day.
Oh, when I was a lad, we had proper sherbet in them little tube things and a licorice straw to suck it up with. You don't get that sort of thing today. People are too busy rushing about.
Sounds a lot better than quaffing toenails, though.
Another pause.
Did you ever believe that business about every enemy you killed becoming your servant in the next world?
Dunno.
How many you killed?
What? Oh, maybe 2,000-3,000, not counting dwarfs and trolls, of course.
Definitely not going to be short of a hairbrush or someone to open doors for you after you're dead, then.
A pause.
We're definitely not going to die, right?
Right.
I mean, odds of 100,000 to 1. Huh. Difference is just a lot of zeros, right?
Right.
I mean, stout comrades at our side, a strong right arm. What more could we want?
Pause.
A volcano would be favourite.
Pause.
We're going to die, aren't we?